Hello, good evening. What a lovely assembly to be sitting with. Well, I think most of you know that something happened here a couple weeks ago. Reverend Dana Takagi and I went through the process of Dharma transmission with Patrick Tiberbaugh and Jean Bush, and assisted deeply by Kokyo Henkel and many of you. So I was invited, as is the tradition, to speak about this. And of course, there's a lot that we don't really talk about with regards to Dharma transmission, but there's a lot that I think can be said as well. So I'm going to talk a bit about transmission. Somebody at the last talk, I think, asked, what is it? What's transmitted? I think somebody asked that, maybe one of you. Anyhow, I thought, well, I'll talk a little bit about that. And then I'd like to talk about the week itself, just the actual body experience of that week. And then some other things. We'll see how the time goes. So, you know, this transmission thing is essentially what it is about intimacy. It's a relationship. It's one person and another person resonating about the mutual understanding of what this is. And it's about being entrusted with this precious gift, which is the Buddha Dharma. You know, Shakyamuni Buddha, our founder, we have these stories about his life experience and how, you know, he was seeking for some meaning in his life, and he went out and tried the practices of the day, the austerities. He really excelled in them, but he felt like that it can't just be about, you know, all this pain and suffering. There's got to be something else that can help us awaken together and be liberated as human beings. So he sat down and said, I'm not going to move until I figure it out. And that was the birth of our religion and the middle way and what we call Buddhism. But all that means, you know, Buddha means being one who is awake. So this entire religion that we have and all these fantastic teachings and ceremonies and practices and robes and all this stuff is all just about this one simple thing, which is awakening together with all beings. That's the core of what the Buddha way is. So this experience of transmission is really having a close relationship with another human being who says, who's a little further along the path than you are in certain ways, and says, yeah, you know, I trust that you're a person who wants to use your life to carry this teaching on. So, go for it. That's it, really. And we have all these activities that we do. You know, there was this week that we called Transmission Week. But it's not like there's these magical things that happen during that week that make transmission happen. It's actually already happened in a way by the mutual recognition and friendship, close Dharma friendship that you have with another human being. And, you know, for me, and I, as Patrick said when he gave the talk at the beginning of the week, you know, we're all mixed up around here in Santa Cruz. You know, Patrick gave me transmission. I started practicing before he did. As he said, I was the Doan when he first came through the door, and I welcomed him into the Zendo. So, you know, on one level, it's like, well, you know, what's that about? But Patrick is ahead of me on the path because Patrick says yes when I say no. So Patrick was ordained before me. Catherine asked us both, and I said, oh, no, I can't do that. And Patrick said, yes, you know. And Patrick received transmission before me. Oh, I can't do that. Patrick said, yes. So, you know, his yes put him in this position to actually be ahead of me on the path and to be able to, through his generosity and his patience with me, also allow me to connect with my root teacher from whom I was estranged. I had a deep powerful, beautiful relationship with Catherine, our abbot, who, it's always very haunting to sit here because this was her seat. You know, this is the guest teacher seat now. Any of you who gives a talk, you sit here. But, you know, for 20 years, this is where Catherine sat. So for those of us that grew up with her, it's always a little bit daunting to sit here. You know, we had a deep, deep, deep intimacy, and we had a difficulty at in the latter part of our relationship. It was really, really hard. And I couldn't say yes to her, you know. So, you know, I will forever be in gratitude at how Patrick supported me to reconnect with her, to engage in communicating deeply with each other, the nature of our difficulties. We got to clear water together, and we forgave one another. And as most of you know, not long after that, she fell down, hit her head, got in a coma, and died. And you never know when that might happen with any of us at any time. So it was just such a profound life lesson for me of, you know, thank God that that Patrick supported me to be able to have that closure with her, so that I could then participate in supporting her parinirvana, you know, the week, that amazing week that many of us spent of helping her die, you know, being here in the Zendo, going over to her house, being with her breathing and her last breaths. How different that would have been for me had I been in a place of having a bitter heart and anger with her. So that's very, very meaningful part for me of the intimacy of this transmission. Is the fact that, you know, it's like Catherine's this big, big old tree. She was a big, strong tree. Yeah, very deeply rooted. And then, you know, there's these little branches that start going off. And, you know, there's the down in Monterey, there's the Robert branch and the Kathy branch. And then up here, there's the Jean branch and the Patrick branch. And, you know, I really like that then my branch is coming off of Patrick's branch and I'm still connected to Catherine. I'm still part of the Catherine tree. I'm part of the lineage, you know. So thank you for allowing me, supporting me, making it possible for me to still be, to stay home, to not have to leave home in order to be able to take my place such as it is. So if you read the stories, this is an amazing thing. Maybe a lot of you know this, but if you don't, I'm going to tell you. Zen has a story for almost every one of these person-to-person transmissions from the time of Buddha through many, many, many of the generations, through the Indian ancestors, the Chinese ancestors, and many of the Japanese ancestors up through a couple of people after Dogen. And then, sadly enough, nobody collected the stories between Dogen and the contemporary teachers, but I'm sure now there's so much material about all the contemporary teachers that, you know, that will be rectified. And maybe someday, at some point, some scholar will go and will actually try to dig up some of the stories about the ancestors for whom we don't have stories. Now, of course, some of these stories, you read them, and they're pretty fantastic, and you think, really? Did that really happen? But it doesn't matter, because that's part of spiritual literature, is we don't worry about that so much. Maybe it happened, maybe it's just a metaphor, it's okay. What you see is relationship. And the stories, the transmission of the light, once a year, Kokyo does a Denko A Sesshin, where he reads these stories. That book, The Transmission of the Light, is literally, it's the story of all these relationships, and it's the stories about the moments where the one in the offering role and the one in the receiving role met. So this is always happening to us all the time. It's not just people who go through transmission and end up with a brown robe. We're all meeting each other all the time. You know, you are meeting the practice every time you step in this, well, not even, I mean, out in the world. Just saying yes to the Buddha Dharma is you receiving the practice. You know, it's offered, something inside you goes, that makes sense to me, awakening together with all beings. I think I want to do that. That's you receiving transmission from Shakyamuni Buddha. You know, it really is. You know, saying yes to coming here, saying yes to each other. This is how we make and continue this experience together. It's nothing else but our relationships with one another. So I've always loved reading those stories because I see the relationship in them. And some of them they're very different. They're very, very, very diverse kinds of experiences that they had. But I really encourage you, if you've never checked it out, to look at those and consider it. Because it's a beautiful part, I think, of our tradition that we have this. So then the week itself was really about honoring these ancestors. It's not part of the secret part of what happens because many of you saw it, so it couldn't be secret if we allow people to see it, right? But basically, there were a series of activities that we did several times every day, which were some version of honoring the ancestors, whether it was going around to all the different altars where they are represented, like on the back of this altar. If you look in there, you'll see Catherine's there, her teacher, Shunryu Suzuki is there, Koban Chino, the founder of this temple, he's there. You know, we go around to the altars around the property. There's these various protector bodhisattvas at the bathroom. Maybe you've never noticed, look up. Right there, you can bow before you go to the bathroom and thank the protector of the bathroom for protecting you in there, you know. For good plumbing, right. And there's a protector at the gate. At the gatehouse, we have little things here, little gatehouse, right? There's a protector in the kitchen. There's one in the inside bathroom. So part of the ritual of this week was like real slow motion, going around and touching in with every single one of these ancestors. And as if that wasn't enough, we also got to say their names a couple times a day, all 93 of the men. Now, I just have to say a tiny bit about this for those of you that maybe don't know. Up until Catherine's generation, all of the transmitted ancestors in our lineage that were recorded were men. Was that because there were no women teachers? No. It's because the cultures and the times, as we all know, it's really only more recently that we're recognizing that, of course, there have been great women teachers all along, but the times didn't really have opening and permission for them to be validated as such. And so one of the things that a lot of our contemporaries have been doing is they've been resurfacing a lot of the stories of great women teachers in India, China, and Japan that sort of paralleled the lives of these male ancestors for which we have a lot of record. So we actually have two lineage charts. The women's isn't technically a lineage because they didn't have that person-to-person-to-person through time transmission that the men did. A few of them did. And when you study, you can see there are probably three different nodules in the women's line where they were direct transmissions. But what I love is, oh, let me back up a minute. So what we've been doing now for about 15 years, maybe, is when we chant the men's lineage, we also honor and chant this women's lineage. So we have the men ancestors and the women ancestors. Here's what I love. As of Catherine and her generation, it's one chart. Because Catherine received full Dharma transmission from Reb, who received it from Baker, who received it from Suzuki, who received it from his teacher. So this like authentic lineage, you know, for what it's worth, she got authentic Dharma transmission in the lineage, and that's where it started to change. So 200 years from now, we'll appreciate and honor, I think, the list of the women teachers, but our lineage will be a unified. It will not discriminate in terms of gender. It already doesn't. And in this temple, we've chosen to put Catherine in that lineage, the Daisho lineage. We don't keep her. Oh, we'll keep her on the women's list. you know. So this is really, really, really big, and these are the kinds of things that maybe we don't always know when we're just in our humble little zendo, what we're doing, but this is really big. It's a huge ripple, I believe, in the Dharma world. So anyhow, what that meant, though, for us was that we had two lists of people that we honored every day. So we did. And even another way that we honored them was we would, twice a day, offer incense, ring the bell, say the name, and do a complete prostration to the floor for each of the ancestors, male and female. So this was a very physical week. And of course, wouldn't you know it, I, who never get sick, the night before we started this week, I went, oh no. I started to feel that awful feeling in your throat when you think something bad is going to happen. And by the next day, I had a temperature and I was really sick. And I shared it with Dana, which I really am sorry, Dana. I'm so, 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 so sorry. It was really hard because we were both really, really sick. But what are you going to do? It's Dharma Transmission Week. So you do the best you can. That's what you do. You do the best you can. And that's what we did. And but here's the thing. So in the beginning of the week, you know, I was sick. I couldn't believe I had to do this. And I, those of you who know me know, I always have this sort of resistance in a way to many of the forms of our beautiful tradition. So I was definitely feeling some crankiness in the beginning of the week. In fact, there was one particular bowing that I think Dana, Jean, and Patrick witnessed, which was pretty hard. I think I was like totally in tears by the end of it, powering through, just feeling really, really horrible. But I was determined to do it. But here's what happened. And it wasn't just that we were bowing and chanting and saying their names and walking around and honoring them. We were also writing their names on silk with black ink that we ground ourselves. And if you don't grind it long enough and you put your brush in the not yet ground enough water and you touch it to your silk, it runs in these spider veins all over your beautiful, you know, 5-foot masterpiece. So you have to wait long enough grinding your ink until it's just right. And you do that by testing it on your little tester silk. And you test it and you go, oh, please, please, please be done. Please be done. Please be done. And then you look down and you go, oh, it's not done. And if it's not done, it's not done. So you just got to keep, you grind. And you're literally grinding this ink stone into the water, and it's becoming this substance that when it's just the right, whatever that word is, there's probably some consistency, then you put your brush in it and you touch it to the ink and it makes this beautiful, sharp, black wine. So you write the names of the ancestors too, several times. So I realized early on, okay, this is really about honoring the ancestors. And I knew that I appreciated that. I knew from, you know, the things that I've said, you know, so far in this talk, I knew that I appreciated that. But what was a revelation to me as I went through this process was the physicality of it and the repetition of it, what that did, that it changed me. And this is, you know, the Zen initiation rituals have this quality. It just is that way. And, you know, if you want to go to the monastery and sit a practice period, you got to do Tongaryo. And it's 5 days of solid zazen, and it's really hard, and you got to do it, you know. And it seems like, you know, sesshin, you want to sit more, and you want to have your, you know, the experience of your mind falling away and the beautiful Sangha treasure. Well, you just got to sit through it. So we have this, I don't know what to call it, it's a difficulty that's just sort of part of our initiation rituals. And this was no exception. And especially being sick. I mean, I was so aware of just the physicality of it. And at first I had this resentment. I felt like, man, I'm just being ground down by this thing. I'm being ground down. But as I, you know, moved into the week and I just, this is what happens. This is why we have these rituals, because something happens and something falls away. And that resistance and that anger and that, you know, I was so upset that I was sick. I couldn't believe it. All of that, at some point, it was just us, and we were just bowing, and then people came, and we were, you know, walking in the rain, and there'd be somebody behind me with an umbrella and holding the incense, and we'd be chanting, and it just turned into this beautiful, physical ritual of honoring. And I thought, honoring what? And I realized, honoring every life. Honoring every life. Hundreds of years later, I think, here I am saying your name, ancestor. And some of you were great, like Sekito Kisen and Ehei Dogen, you know. And some of you, who were you? There aren't even stories about you. But I'm saying your name because you lived a life dedicated to awakening with all beings. And thank you for that. And I think Sally was holding my umbrella, and it was raining, and we were walking on School Street, and I just had this body vision of, oh, it's like, I'm the ink stone, and the water is the Buddha Dharma, and this process is grinding us together. And this is the initiation of this ancestor path. For me, that's this experience, this visceral experience of literally being ground into the Buddha Dharma. This feeling of just completely giving our lives to one another, that's really the invitation here. That's what the ancestors did for us. They gave us their lives. And that's what we can do for each other. And I felt that during the week. I mean, it was so sweet and so beautiful. People cooked, and, you know, Shoho made cookies every day. I'd like, you know, walk in the house and there'd be the next plate of cookies. And one morning when I was in there, just I had to leave the Zendo because I had these coughing fits, and I was just hysterical with coughing. And I'm sitting in there coughing and coughing, and she's in the kitchen making ginger, honey, lemon, cayenne tea. I mean, you know, it was just everybody just, and even the people who didn't do anything and who didn't know about it or who wanted to do something, like Gene said in his talk, it's not over. We can all continue to contribute to this experience together of creating and sustaining the Buddha way by everything that we all do together here. Gene said, he gave the talk after the process, and he, with my permission, told a funny thing, and I'll tell it again because it's connected to what I'm saying. This experience of having the ancestor way just kind of ground into me and being really, really, really good with it. So much so that when I got home, and I, of course I was just exhausted, you know, finally I like to sit, because I'm also getting up early every morning, and you know how much I like that, and I'm every day, you know, coming, and anyhow, it was really something, and then we had these late night ceremonies. So by the time it was over, I was just so exhausted, I could hardly move, so I went to bed, crashed, it was probably about 10 o'clock in the morning, and I think I slept for 3.5 hours. And he said, he was out in the living room, he said he heard me calling out in my sleep, some of you already heard this, from the room where I was sleeping, Dayusho! Dayusho! Acharya! And I just love that, you know, because it's like, yeah, that's what happened. It got in me. It worked, you know. This ancient process, you know, it worked. And it may seem really kind of primitive, but that's our way. That is our way. You know, you don't go to the university and get a degree, and you don't get, you know, the Pope doesn't come and bless your head. I mean, you get ground down into the water and bow to the ground hundreds and hundreds of times, and that's what we do. So after that experience, then certain kinds of words really take on, they really resonate. So during Patrick's talk, he read a section from the Shobo Genzo, and it's actually the introduction to the ancestors that is part of what you say twice a day when you're doing this bowing for every ancestor. And I'll read it again. Actualizing the Buddha ancestors means to bring them forth and look at them respectfully. It is taking up those who have maintained the face and eye of the Buddha ancestors, formally bowing and meeting them. I'll read that again. That's an exact description to me of what it felt like. You know, actualizing the Buddha ancestors. What I love that word, actualizing. It means bringing it to life. It means that, you know, whatever we say we want to do in our practice, we try to do it. We don't just think about it. We don't just wish for it. We don't just beat ourselves up because we're not doing it. We just try to actualize it. So actualizing the Buddha ancestors means to bring them forth and look at them respectfully. So this experience of naming them, writing them, you know, studying them, and not them as objects, not them as historical figures, but just them as examples of people just like us doing their best to actualize the Buddha Dharma in their own way with their own life circumstances. And they had varied life circumstances. Some of them were very poor. There was one who was a leper. Some of them were rich. Some of them were like, had these really close relationships with their mothers and grandmothers who had spiritual dreams about them, you know. Some of them were orphans. I mean, it was, you know, the women, oh my God, you read about some of the things they had to go through just to get to practice, just to get to sit zazen, how they had to push their way into these, you know, this male-dominated system and just say, no, I want to do it too. All the way back to Mahapajapati. Buddha's aunt who raised him, who suckled him, because his mom had died. And he wouldn't even let her ordain until she just finally just wouldn't let him get away with it. And with the help of Ananda, you know, Buddha finally gave in and said, okay, you can practice. So actualizing the Buddha ancestors means bringing them forth, looking at them respectfully. It is taking up those who have maintained the face and the eye of the Buddha ancestors, formally bowing and meeting them. Thank you. 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 Everybody, all of us together. So there's one other thing I want to talk about, and then I do want to make some time for you, if you have anything you want to ask or say. But another thing that happened that I want you to know is that I also got my name changed a little bit. And so my Dharma name, Catherine gave me in 95 when I did my lay ordination or got my blue Jukai Rakusu. And she called me at that time Myoka Kumon. Myoka meaning bright song. And Kumon, Ku meaning emptiness, and Mon, complete or fulfilled. And this went back to our original meeting where, I won't tell the whole story, but I have a story of, kind of a how I came to Zen story that involved an experience in the desert where I was given a name that I was very afraid of by a symbolic process that I was involved in. And the name was Empty-Handed Raven. And I didn't understand it. It scared me to death. I had received the name in a moment of real anguish in the middle of the night. And I literally had come to Zen with some real curiosity about wanting to understand more about the emptiness, because I'd heard that Zen and had a lot, something to say about emptiness. So my very first Dokusan with Catherine, which actually happened right out where the heater is right now, that used to be the Dokusan room, my very first Dokusan, I sat down with this nice lady who had just come to town and told her about my experience and getting this name and saying, what is emptiness, you know? So she thought, oh, okay, we'll talk about that. And what she told me, I'd never heard anything like it. I had no idea. I thought emptiness meant alone and empty and like the void and nothing and nothingness and nihilism. And, you know, what she told me was actually in Buddhism, emptiness means everything. It means that we're so completely connected with the whole world that there's nothing outside of that. And that's what we mean by empty. And I thought, okay. So really, I can say a lot of my early years of practice was literally about studying emptiness. And so when she gave me that in my name, Kumon, it was, further sort of encouragement and validation to keep really studying that. And it was a part of our relationship. And I liked it and I loved it. And when she ordained me as a priest, she kept the same name. And very commonly, the teacher will give a new name when you have your priest ordination. I think both Jean and Patrick got new names at their, no, you didn't? You got, at your transmission, but you got a new name at your priest ordination?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, did you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you, Dana? Did you, Shaho? Okay, so some do, but at least 50% here. Well, I didn't. I had the same name, and that was my name, right? But as I went through the years after my ordination, the 10 years since I was ordained, very difficult 10 years, I kind of had this feeling like I wouldn't mind having a new name. Because I felt like I've gone through a lot of stuff since 1995. I didn't say anything. I didn't mention this, but I thought it. So when Patrick told me that he had changed one syllable in my name, I was kind of excited because it was like, oh my God, I wonder what it's going to be. And he explained me why he had chosen it, and I won't tell everything because, you know, some things have to remain private. But what it is he kept the Myoka, the bright song, and instead of Kumon, of emptiness fulfilled, it's Ganmon. Gan means vow. So now I'm really going, oh, I'm going to study more about vow. This is kind of a gateway for me with this new outfit is vow. And in the ceremonies, the expression of vow for me was that a whole bunch of times I said, yes, I will. So that's vow to me. It's yes, I will. And we say this knowing we're gonna fail. Please, it's not like, oh, you see, this is the thing, we torture ourselves. We have these, our vows are impossible. Give it up. We vow to save all beings, to be present with every single living being, to awaken with all beings, every single one. We vow to end all of our delusions, all of the ways that we separate ourselves from others, all the stories we tell ourselves in our minds, all the ways that we torture ourselves, you know, we vow to end, to stop that, right? We vow to enter all Dharma gates, to be open to all the teachings in all their forms, and we vow to become Buddha's way. So it's impossible. And yet, that's our vow as bodhisattvas, if we're practicing the bodhisattva way. So it's not about being good little boys and girls and being perfect. But it's not about, oh well, since it's impossible, it doesn't matter, so I can do whatever I want. This is the kind of delicious dilemma of our Mahayana approach. We do our best to fulfill those vows. But we also do that recognizing that the other side of vow, I was reading in Okamura's beautiful book, Living by Vow. Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful book. And he says there's actually two aspects to vow. Vow and confession. That we just have to know that this is part of the deal. That we set our direction, we make our aspiration, we tell everyone, this is why I'm telling you this, you know, we say, this is my intention. And then we know that we're gonna slip up, but rather than just going, oh well, I might as well give up, we confess it, which just means that we say what we did, and then we recommit. That's the repentance. And in fact, in the Ehe Koso Hotsugan Mon, which the title of which means Ehe Dogen's kind of poem for arousing vow, that's what it means. It's his pep talk, basically. What's it all about? Well, a lot of it is about Buddhas and ancestors are the same as we in the future shall be Buddhas and ancestors. Before Buddhas were enlightened, they were the same as we in the future shall be them. So a big part of what arouses vow is to recognize, is to take our place just in this lineage of humanity and realize that, you know, the generosity of their practice allows us to practice. And when we can find our way to generosity, we're now going to be supporting those in the future. We support the next generation by our generosity of practice. And the other thing, that latter part of that sutra or poem, I don't know, it's not really a sutra, his treatise, is confessing and repenting before the Buddhas melts away the root of transgressions. By confessing our lack of practice and faith before the Buddhas, we melt away the root of transgression. So this is very powerful. This is what Dogen is telling us. This is the practice. The practice. So, you know, I may not always be able to do all the things that I think I'm supposed to do to be a good Zen student. Like, get here every morning or remember where my thumb goes when I'm doing the offering. Is it above or is it below? Oh, no. Okay, it's either above or below, so I'll try above. No, not above. It was below. Okay, next time, I'll try to remember to keep it down, right? This is how it goes. This is... All right, there it is. Yeah, see Patrick. He kindly comes up to me after, Kathy, the thumb goes there. I'm like, okay, you know. So you can count on me. I'm going to try, but I may not, that's not my forte. I may not always be able to do that, but you can count on me that I am committed to being here for you forever, whatever and however and whomever. You can count on that. That's my vow. And you can count on it that I'm gonna mess up. And if you need to help me remember and help me see it and then bear witness to my confession and celebrate my repentance, well, that would be great because I need you to help me with that. So, couple things and then I'll see if there's anything that wants to be said. This is just a couple things about vow. This is from Okamura's book. He says, the vow, yes, I will, comes from the deepest place in yourself. Intellectually, it seems impossible, but from our deep life force, we can't help but say, yes, I will. That is vow. It is not made by the intellect or an emotional impulse. It should come from the deepest part of us. Living by vow means to sit, to try to help others, to live and work with others each day of our life. It's like, okay, I can commit to that. To sit, to try to help others, to live and to work with others each day of our life. He also calls it the dynamic day-to-day expression of the most fundamental aspect of our true nature. And then I'll close here with Katagiri also talking about vow. I'm just starting to really study again what's out there. So he says, just to be present and swim in Buddha nature, this is living the bodhisattva vow to help all beings. Then the great energy of the universe supports you, and you take one step toward the future with all beings. So helpful. Just to be present and swim in Buddha nature. That's what we're doing here. And then the universe supports us, and we take that one step, and then we take the next step. And that's what we're doing. So we have 7 minutes or so. If anybody wants to say anything or ask anything. Thank you. I feel the same way about you. Well, you know, it felt like something I could do. It took a long time, and I really wasn't sure for a while. But it really, at some point, I was like, yeah, I can. I can do it. Thank you. Yeah. Well, I really love people, and I just find that this practice allows me to participate more wholeheartedly in the human experience. I just see how the practice impacts people, how we change, I think, for the better. I think everybody in this room, you know, we because we just keep trying. It's not better like superior, but the fact, I mean, I'm so moved by this continuous effort and the emphasis in Buddhism on effort. You know, there's so much complacency and resignation and bitterness and cynicism in the world that it's just very, very, I just feel like gratitude to be when I'm among people who really do want good things for others and are doing what they can with their resources to support other beings, and whether that be through activism or through a more contemplative approach. I think both are really honorable traditions and ways to try to have a more humane world. Yeah, Liz.
Ordinariness and the extraordinariness of honoring other lives and just being present. It really is an encouragement. I feel
Well, that's what I want to do, so thank you. We encourage each other, you know, in so many ways. Oh, I did want to say one last thing, so I'll say that. I guess I wanted to make a little pitch for the theme of the year, because it's connected with what we're just talking about now, devotion. So, you know, this year, there will be kind of an extra focus on devotion. And so I just encourage everybody to find ways to participate. You know, we're going to be studying the Lotus Sutra, which is really the heart teaching of Mahayana Buddhism. That was where Shakyamuni Buddha said, you know, we're all in this together. No difference. And there's going to be a class in the precepts, the ethical conduct of Buddhism in the fall. There's going to be opportunities to chant. I think, what is that, 9-hour chanting extravaganza that Shoho is going to be sponsoring. And there's going to be sesshins with all of our practice leaders. We're going to experiment with having a day sit, which includes time to engage in creative expression. So there's going to be just a lot of different ways that we can find our way into expressing our devotion. And I think I'll just close with saying, you know, to me, one of the most profound ways to do that is just to come to service. You know, if you're a person who usually doesn't come to service, add one in per week, you know. If you've never come in the morning, come and try the morning, or maybe write the full moon. You know, look at the annual calendar. Write the full moon ceremony on your calendar, because this is our main way in that we kind of ceremonially practice devotion in our tradition is through chanting together, joining our voices, and honoring different qualities of practice. So I look forward to it, and I encourage you to practice, and may we all grow deeper in our devotion to the Buddha way. Beings are numberless, I bow to save them.
Delusions are inexhaustible, I bow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I bow to enter them. Buddha. I bow to become it.